The Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Today we're going to talk about private schools. First, we're going to take a look at a controversy within the Hillsborough public school system, and there will be a protest today about that controversy. And then a little bit later on, we're going to talk with the author of a book called Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. This is 88.5 FM. And we're going to talk right now with two members of the Hillsborough School Employees Federation. The Hillsborough School Board is studying the idea of turning over work that's now done by unionized custodians to a private company instead. But activists who want to stop the privatization before the idea gets too much traction are holding a rally this afternoon. And we're joined by two of those activists with the Hillsborough School Employees Federation, Stephanie McNeil and Jackie McAllister. And Stephanie and Jackie, welcome to WMNF. Nice to see you. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So is Hillsborough County planning to privatize some of the services at the schools?
They are definitely planning on privatizing. They have sent out an RFP, which means that companies will now bid on the job. So what they want is they want as many companies as possible, and they want to find whoever can do the job for the least amount of money.
How many employees would be affected? Are we talking about janitors and how many employees?
We're talking about janitors. We call them custodians.
Okay.
And these are all unionized employees, and we're talking about around 1,500. 200 of those roughly are head custodians, which do not fall under our union contract, but the rest of the employees, around 1,300, all fall under our contract.
Now, does this idea catch you off guard? Is this a surprise to you?
Absolutely, because about 3 years ago, the district spent around $1 million to have a consultant group come in, which is called Gibson Consulting, and the direction of that consultant group, or the advice that consultant group gave, was to centralize custodians, which means the district still owns them, they keep all of their insurance, they're still unionized, but we just do things a little differently. And we've been working on that plan for around 2 years. And overnight, they informed us that they are going to look to privatize.
And what's the downside in your mind to privatization?
Well, to privatization, it hurts not only the school district, because the school district now has no control. It definitely hurts the workers. Everyone loses their pension. They lose their medical insurance, all of their benefits, their sick days. And they go, most of the time, these companies hire them at minimum wage. So right now, all of our custodians come in at $10 an hour, which was a struggle just to get them to $10 an hour. We've been negotiating for over 4 years just to get them to that point. And now they're going to drop to minimum wage, which negatively affects the community. All of the community resources, these employees are going to go out and apply for community resources like welfare, food stamps, all of the assistance that they'll need to just survive and keep their families fed. And so that's going to put a huge strain on the community.
And Jackie, do all these folks who are now custodians, do they have sick days and access to a pension plan and have a health care plan?
Absolutely. And they rely on that. Yeah. A lot of them work, they may work second jobs, but they work here primarily for their benefits.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if the privatized workers, will they get any of these benefits that the public employees get right now?
Absolutely not.
So we take people who are now have a chance of becoming middle class, and we turn them into poverty workers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So today there's going to be a protest against this. Where's the protest going to be, Stephanie?
Yes, the protest is going to be at our building, which is 5126 North Florida Avenue. The young workers, which is primarily a new group of young unionized workers in Hillsborough County, are going to come out and we're going to rally just to bring attention to this issue. Also, Tuesday, we'll be rallying at the school board building during a school board workshop from 9 a.m. to 11, and then again from 3:30 until 6 p.m. during the actual school board meeting. We're going to have the president of the Florida Education Association is going to be out there from Tallahassee. Sean Shaw, the former candidate for the state attorney general, he's going to be out there in the morning speaking to employees and trying to sway the district to change their mind.
Has a company been identified? I mean, you're both union activists. Has a company been identified as the company that would take this private contract?
The ones that are really pushing and have privatized a lot of school districts around the United States is Aramark or Sodexo. Those are the big companies that are really pushing. We believe that those are probably the only companies who could actually come in and without subcontracting out to different smaller companies, they're actually the only ones that could take on the job and be the only company that takes on the job. The other companies we believe are too small to do the work that needs to be done. We are a huge district. We have over 200 schools, and that's a lot of work for small companies from Hillsborough County.
When a company like Aramark or Sodexo, I can never pronounce it, when it comes in and lobbies our school board in Hillsborough County, do they leave a trail? Do they have to say that we're lobbyists and we're asking to get a contract and we've signed in at the school board desk to say that we've met with the superintendent or we've met with members of the board?
A lot of times, everyone has to sign in at the school board building. Now, what they do on their own time, absolutely not. I'm sure that just like we had transportation companies that came in and like Bluebird and they lobbied school board members like by taking them to lunch or things like that, as long as the district money isn't paying for it and it's not at the district building, they do pretty much what they want to do.
Let me ask what the two of you do when you're not active on union issues. What is your job at the school
district? I'm a school bus driver. Mm-hmm. I've been a school bus driver for almost 15 years with the school district. Before that, I worked in the kitchen. I went from a student nutrition worker in the kitchen to a school bus driver. And now I'm still a school bus driver, but I'm on release to the union to fight the fight that we have ahead of us.
And Jackie McAllister, same thing.
I also am a bus driver. I've been a bus driver for 18 years. And when I was released to come into the union, we do things, we help different areas, different units, and we represent. We make sure that the contract is followed. So we work with not just custodians, but bus drivers, school security. We have several different units that work under us.
And this would all be under the Hillsborough School Employees Federation. That would be the general.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, I'd heard years ago, and I don't know what it is now, but are the conditions better for school bus drivers in Hillsborough County? Because I heard that they were at one point underpaid and that some of the buses didn't have drivers because the pay was so low. Is that a problem now?
The conditions are better. We are still short drivers, but the conditions are better. There's a lot of reasons why we're short drivers. I think a lot of that has to do with you're a 10-month employee versus a 12-month employee. So for 2 months out of the year, you're looking for another job, which can be an issue for some, some people. And so I think that's an issue. The pay is a lot better than it was. When I started, it was $9. It is now over $13, which is a huge jump. We've had probably around a 30% increase in wages since I've been in the union, since I've been working for the union on release. So that's a huge increase as far as bus drivers are concerned.
Mm-hmm. And does it help create a middle class? If the wage went from $9 to $13 an hour, does that help people who are driving a bus enter the middle class?
It helps, but we're still not at a living wage. So when we talk about being a 10-month employee, even at $13 an hour, in order to try to create that middle class, we would have to at least pay them $15 an hour. So we are still well below that living wage because it's just not enough. It's a 10-month employee. You're being paid $13 an hour, which is great, but you're still only working 10 months of the year. So your base salary is hitting right at around $21,000 a year, which isn't enough to support a family of 3 or 4.
Yeah, it's really below the poverty level.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So getting back to there's going to be a protest today, and you said there's going to be a protest at the school board meeting on Tuesday. So today's protest, where does it take place and what time is it? And this is against the privatization of custodial jobs in the Hillsborough school system.
The Protest tonight will take place at the HSEF building on Florida Avenue, 5126 North Florida Avenue. It will start at 5:30, and we will be out there till around 6:30 protesting with our signs. And then on Tuesday, May 7th, it will start at 9 a.m. at the school board building, and we'll go till 11 during a school board workshop. We want to make sure that they know we're there. And then all of our employees who cannot make it to the morning protest will be there from 3:30 to 6 in the evening with all of the teachers in Hillsborough County, because our sister union, HCTA, will be supporting us at the 3:30 to 6 o'clock meeting.
Has the issue been scheduled for discussion at the school board level? Have they said, well, on this day, we're going to talk about possible privatization of the custodial services?
Not at a school board meeting yet. The school board members are absolutely discussing this, but not at a meeting yet. The deadline has now been moved for the second time to May 14th is the deadline for all of the RFP bids to be in. So once that ends, it'll eventually get to the school board. There has to be a committee. There's a process. In the district, there's a process in place that says once the RFPs come in, we set up a committee, we look at everything, and then the superintendent has the right to bring it to the school board, or he has the right to not bring it to the school board.
I've got a friend who's a custodian in one of the local public schools in Hillsborough County. He said that he was given a letter a couple days ago saying that the letter wanted him to identify the number of bathrooms, the number of spaces he cleaned, everything that he was responsible for as the head custodian at this school. And he told me, and he's not part of the union, he told me that this was the beginning of the attempt at privatization.
Absolutely.
Why would a list need to be compiled of everything that's being cleaned?
Okay. So when you say that, that's a surprise to me also, because we met with the superintendent probably 2 weeks ago, and he assured us that right now we are looking at two options. We are looking at privatization. We're waiting for bids to come in. But we're also going to go back to what the Gibson report told us, and we're going to look at centralization too. So the fact that they are giving out forms for people to fill out how many bathrooms you're cleaning, how many classrooms, what that tells me is that we know that the RFP was poorly written. And so because it was poorly written and a lot of the contractors who are bidding are having issues with some of the wording, what that says to me is the mistakes that are in the RFP, they are now wanting the custodians that are on the ground to correct. So in the Fish report, the square footage and the bathrooms, everything isn't 100% correct. So my thought is they're giving this to the custodians so that they can have accurate numbers to give these companies to move privatization forward.
And then the companies would bid based on the number of bathrooms and the square footage.
Correct.
And it's helping the companies create a bid.
And they want our own employees, who they're trying to get rid of, to help these companies take their job.
And where's the Hillsborough, this afternoon's protest is at 5 o'clock. Where's the Hillsborough School Employees Federation office?
It's right on Florida Avenue, 5126 North Florida Avenue.
And it's right near the corner of Hillsborough in Florida?
It's right by the bakery is the big place on Florida Avenue. So it's right by the bakery.
Okay. So the La Segunda, it's the other bakery.
Yes, yeah, it is. Okay. I can't remember the name right now, but yes.
Mauricio Fado.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming by. How can people contact the union if they want to? Can they go online or can they call the union?
Absolutely. They can get all of this information. We are at hsefonline.org, and they can absolutely call us at any time. The phone number is 813-231-2030, and we are available to answer any questions. We would love for parents and students and anyone who can make it out either tonight or Tuesday morning or Tuesday evening to come out and support us and our custodians.
Well, Stephanie McNeil and Jackie McAllister, thank you so much for coming by on WMNF. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. Is there a war on public schools? We're going to talk about that in just a moment.
noite eterna. Zidida hariko kumsoro. Anoya mbuta pazambuko. Kukuburitza murucha. Akunjenge sapanjozi.
That's music from Oliver Mitikudzi. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. Our next guest has authored a book called Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. He's Arthur Shapiro. He graduated from the University of Chicago with a PhD, and he is in the education College of Education at the University of South Florida here in Tampa. He's been a high school principal. He's been a high school teacher, rather, middle school teacher and an elementary teacher, and he's also been a senior high school principal, the director of secondary education, and assistant superintendent and superintendent of schools. He's got a lot of experience. And Arthur, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
All right. So I want to ask you about the state legislature, which is moving very quickly to expand school vouchers here in the state of Florida. They want to spend $130 billion beginning with the fiscal year that starts July 1st. Yep. And they want to give 18,000 taxpayer-funded school vouchers so kids can opt out of the public school system and go to a private school. What do you make of them?
Well, that's part of the privatization movement that your two previous people were talking about. And that's a major social movement. Privatization, among other movements too, like the Me Too movement, the anti-vax movement. These are all social movements, and yeah, it's an attempt to privatize. It had some problems with the previous Supreme Court in the state. They turned it down.
In 2006, they turned it down. They said you can't use tax money.
Right. They said it was unconstitutional. But now there are three replacements for more liberal justices, and I think that they're going to test it and see if they can pull it off.
So what's the argument against giving school vouchers? Why are you opposed to giving school vouchers?
That's a good question. School vouchers, as it's set up, can be used for any private school or for religious school. Well, the Blaine Amendment says you can't use public funds to support religion. And so it violates the Blaine Amendment. It violates the separation of church and state.
And the Blaine Amendment is part of the Florida Constitution.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So the Blaine Amendment was, I think, passed in the 20s. Some Catholics say, well, look, this was part of the anti-Catholic fervor in the 1920s. Yep. And there was anti-Catholic fervor back then. And it was an attempt, I think, back then to say, look, we're not going to give public money to the newly formed parochial schools that are popping up around the state.
That's been a tradition, I think, for the whole country to have a wall between church and state. Mm-hmm. And that's usually that's been really an excellent policy.
You're saying it goes beyond being anti-Catholic. Now it's just saying like public money should not be used for any religious school, whether it's Catholic or Buddhist or Protestant or Muslim or Jewish.
Well, most people in the majority religion religious movements realize that some of them would like to have monies from public monies, but if you begin getting really sectarian schools. Sectarian religions are very, very unusual religions. They begin having some doubts. If you do it for one religion, you do it for all religions, and so you begin getting people saying, "Oh, wait a minute."
Yeah, because some people disagree with some religions.
Yes.
We're talking with Arthur Shapiro. His book is Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Arthur's book was just published last year. In the beginning, you talk about a checklist for destroying public education. That's essentially your first chapter.
Right.
What are some of the things in the checklist of how to take steps to destroy public education?
Well, let's see. Let me take a look. What you do is to essentially try to make sure that public education becomes disrespected. So what you do is you set up tests. Then you rig the tests so that a lot of kids don't make it. In this state, when we first began testing, they set up the tests so that in third grade. That's very questionable because you've got a lot of small and immature boys who don't do very well by third grade. By fourth, they catch up, but you set it up to the third grade. Then you test the living daylights out of the kids, and you can set the standards any way you want. At first, they set it up so that there were about 44,000 third graders who wouldn't pass. In actuality, it turned out about 29,000 first third graders wouldn't pass. Well, that's about 15% of the third graders were about 190,000. So if a bunch of kids can't pass it, it proves, well, the schools aren't doing very well. We got to get those lazy teachers going. Then there was another one. You get particularly high poverty schools. Kids in high poverty schools don't do very well. Well, yeah, if they have just a single mother who's working two jobs, they're not going to do very well because they're not going to have attention paid to them, not going to be helping with reading and so forth. So this is a good way to besmirch public schools. And there are some other comments that I made here. One of them was, appointing a political powerhouse to be the Secretary of Education, who hates public schools and thinks it's her God-given mission to privatize schools. Well, you begin altering the balance. I've got another one here. You eliminate tenure. Well, as soon as you eliminate tenure, teachers have no rights. They're at-will workers. They can be fired on the spot. So they begin having a serious problem in terms of standing up to bullying principals. And let me tell you, there is a lot of bullying by administrators, even in universities as well as public schools, and I've seen it happen. Mm. So these are some of the issues that you have.
You don't like the grading system. You think the grading system, when you rate a school an A, B, C, D, or F, that's not really helpful to parents to understand what's going on in that school. Why not?
Well, some wise wag, I was going to say a wise something else, said that Governor Bush, who instituted this, has found a very expensive way to get the social level of the school. All the schools who are in well-to-do communities, upper middle class suburban communities, they do very well. They get A's and B's.
They always get A's. If their parents are well paid and their parents have a high income, then that school is going to do well.
Right, and they work with the kids. The lower on the socioeconomic level the schools are, You get B's, you get C's and D's and F's, and it's a propaganda tool. It's a very clever propaganda tool. Well, who wants your kid to go to a D or a C or a school, let alone an F school? So it's a very clever way to denigrate schools, and it's very effective.
So if we give parents and children vouchers to go to private schools, I mean, the parents, and I think there's some loyal parents out there that are taking vouchers, sending their kids to private schools. First of all, does that cover the entire cost of the typical private school when you get a voucher that's worth $7,000 or
$8,000? No, I don't think it covers the cost. Private schools, there's been a tradition of private schools in this country since the beginning of the Republic, way before that, since the colonies. And that's legitimate. But if you begin using public school money, public money, the money for the schools comes from taxes. That means that the taxes that you pay, let's say if I pay $1,000, if $100 of it goes to a private school, that's taking money that you pay for public school education and shifting it into private schools. And that's not what the founders intended, but that's what's happening.
So are there better outcomes when parents take the vouchers and send their kids to private schools?
It depends upon the private school. We have a whole bunch of vouchers. We have a whole bunch of charter schools. And those are private. Those are public schools, but they're run by private people. The results in 2009, there was a study by Stanford, which indicated that about 17% of the private school of the vouchers of charters schools were superior to matched public schools. So there's a question as to whether how accurate that is, but okay, 39% were worse. The rest were about even. Governor Bush came up with the going back to the ABC, I've participated in evaluating schools. You go there, and it's a 2.5-day operation. You find out what the purpose of the school are, and then you look at what's the nature of the faculty, what are their expertise, are they properly teaching in their areas. For instance, if you have someone who's an expert in biology, are they teaching in biology? If you have people who are not, that's a serious question. And then you take a look at the physical facility and so forth. The ABC is a very fast way of evaluating a school, but it's extremely inaccurate. Hmm. It doesn't tell you what the school's all
but
about.
Just getting back to the private schools, yeah. Though, not the charter schools, but if we got back to the private schools, are the outcomes better when a public school parent takes their kid out, and let's say right now in Florida we have those taxpayer-funded scholarships that are really tax breaks for mm-hmm. giant companies, and that's how we're funding the vouchers now.
Yeah.
Next year we're going to expand that, it looks like. But when you look at the outcomes for private schools, are they better when a parent removes their child from a public school and puts them in a private school?
Depends upon whether the private school is well run. It depends upon the social class of the private school. The social class really, really trumps almost everything.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a high class student body, that school is likely to be a better performing school.
Yeah, there was a very famous governor, Lester Maddox of Georgia, who said there's an easy way to get a better prison. Just get a better class of prisoners. Well, you can apply that to students. Improve the school, get a better class of students.
Our guest is Arthur Shapiro. His book is Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. One of the things that's happening around the state, it looks like the legislature is going to say to local communities like Tampa, like Hillsborough County, rather, that have raised the local sales tax, or if they raise the local property tax, that school district now has to share the proceeds from the increase in taxes with charter schools.
With charter schools, yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, that's the whole business of privatization has become a big issue in the elite and in the politicians. And the politicians generally are fairly well educated, fairly well off economically. So they tend the upper classes and the political classes tended to be supportive of this, not all. Because there's a big issue about that. Generally, one group tends not to do that. I've been in education long enough to remember when politicians didn't think that they had the wisdom to tell educators what's a good practice and what's not a good practice. But now we have that. We have very, very evident in the last 15 or so years attempting to run the schools. Have legislators run the schools, governors run the schools. Well, maybe some of them have some good ideas, but they often don't. They often are following just patterns, and one of the patterns is to try to privatize schools. So that's why you're having an emphasis on charters and vouchers.
I'm wondering the same question about charter schools that I asked you about private schools. Do charter schools measure up? Are the outcomes better when a parent takes their child from a traditional public school and puts them in one of these mostly privately run charter schools?
Yeah. We can talk about the benefits to the owners of charter schools in a minute.
There's big profits to be made.
Oh, big? Big isn't the word. You can become a multimillionaire very rapidly if you run an online charter school. Again, that comes to the issue of we are using our property taxes to pay for that. But anyway.
But the outcomes for a charter school, how do they compare?
They're mixed. In 2009, they weren't very good. By now, they've learned a few things, the ones that have survived. And so the Stanford again came out in 2013, 2015, and said the results are fairly similar using that methodology. But charter schools pick their kids. Many charter schools don't pick kids with English difficulty. kids with who really speak a foreign language. They don't pick kids who have emotional problems. They don't pick kids who are special ed kids, so that they have essentially got a different class of kids. And so if you want to say, well, ours is a good school, yeah, but a good school also can educate everybody, and the charter schools tend not to.
So you're saying they pick the cream of the crop?
Sure, they cream kids. They also want me to tell you something else.
Please do.
The Swedes went into charter schools, and so did the Chileans, and they found out that charter schools were a segregating influence, and they were kind of horrified. The Chileans had 19 million people, had a million people out protesting against the charterization of their schools, and they're beginning to abandon them because you don't need to resegregate your schools. And
Do we have segregation now? Are more and more white parents taking their kids out of public schools?
That's happening. But the problem is, we've had, for instance, over 960 charter schools in this state, okay? 330 have collapsed. So they've collapsed because of lousy grades, or because of financial problems, or because of outright fraud and theft. And so they've collapsed. So you have a third of your schools collapsing. This is true also nationally. 6,000 private charters, 2,500 have collapsed. Now there's also some neat tricks that you can use. For instance, Michigan had 25 ghost schools.
And what are they?
Well, a ghost school is a charter school that the state kicks in money to start, but they don't open.
But they keep the money.
They keep the money.
Mm. Arthur Shapiro is our guest. The book is Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And if you've got a question or comment, you can call us up. Here's our phone number. It's 813-239-9663. You can also send an email into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. Frank Knox and Patty Perkey are behind the scenes making this show happen. So, Arthur, what are the solutions? I mean, there's no doubt that some parents are worried about their kids' school, and you know, there are some problems. What are some of the ways to create better public schools without privatization and without giving money to these people that are going to close down the school in a year or two?
One of the interesting things, I wrote a book about this, about size of schools. And if you decentralize schools, that is, if you can take a school that's 2,000, 1,000, and have smaller units, that's a very effective way to improve the school. It takes some intelligence. It takes some time. It takes a couple, 3 years to take a high school of 2,000 and put it into small houses of 600, 700. When kids are in a huge school, for instance, I saw a very good principal at the end of the year saying to 2,400 kids that I was working with, he was saying, "Are you a student here? Are you a student here? Doc, I've been here. But you don't know me. You can't know 2,000 kids. You really can't know 1,000 kids. You can know 600."
Mm-hmm.
And once you settle and settle down and have a decentralized school in a larger school, the kids feel better. They feel everybody knows them in their unit, and they do better. Even poor kids do 80 to 90% better on their math tests.
Let's talk about some other ideas about making public schools better. What's the ideal class size in a public school?
An interesting study in Tennessee for an elementary 13 to 17. So I asked Chuck Achilles, who was the lead author of that study, and it was a very good study. I said to him, "Okay, 13 to 17. Chuck, why 17? He said, "If they're experienced, they can handle more kids. But if they're not so experienced, 13 is really what is the best size for an elementary school. In high school, a little bit larger."
I imagine that there's no school in our listening area, whether it's Sarasota or Hillsborough or Pinellas or Polk or Pasco or Manatee, there's no school that has classes that small.
Elementary, yeah.
Some of the elementaries do?
Unless they have team taught.
Yeah.
Team teaching is a real good method for improving instruction and having if a kid doesn't do well with one teacher, if you have a team of two or three teachers, generally the kid can relate better with one other teacher.
We have a problem in Florida, and that is that a lot of teaching positions go unfilled throughout the year. So you have substitute teachers that haven't really worked on the lesson plan. They're in there for that missing math teacher or biology teacher.
Yep.
Next year, the number of unfilled teaching positions in Florida is expected to be about 7,000 statewide. Tell me, why do you think that we're having so many unfilled teaching positions in the state of Florida?
Oh, because teachers are being portrayed as lazy, as incompetent. If you have a bunch of kids who are not doing well on the tests, well, look at the lazy teachers. The teachers, I've been in hundreds and hundreds of school classes, thousands, and I really rarely have ever seen a lazy teacher. The teachers really break their backs to work with the kids. But with this negative attitude toward, well, you're in a C school, a D school, then they feel ashamed, and they feel that they've been told that they're not very good. Look at what we do now with evaluating teachers. We evaluate teachers on the basis of tests that kids take in generally February, March. Well, if your kids are poor kids, they're not going to do very well.
Mm-hmm.
A good study by David Berliner said that teachers, on the average, contribute about 10 to 12% of what kids learn. But that's not what the propaganda is. The propaganda is that, it's a teacher's fault if they're not learning. So teachers are
all right, so if the studies say that teachers only contribute 10 to 12% of what students learn through the course of K through 12 education...
Yep.
Who contributes the most?
Family.
So it all depends on what kind of start you get in your family and how much reading goes on inside that family and how much discussion goes on about academic subjects in the family.
Exactly.
Really.
So in the meantime, teachers are denigrated. And so you have a lot of people who thought of becoming teachers, but they're not. So of course you have this is national, of course, so you have shortages in all 50 states have shortages.
Florida is now 47th in the nation when it comes to teacher pay. We're only slightly above, average teacher pay in Florida is only slightly above that of Mississippi. Our pay, roughly on average, is about $47,000 a year.
Yep.
Mississippi is about $44,000, maybe $45,000. What impact does teacher pay have on retaining good teachers?
Well, you know, I've worked with schools here, worked with superintendents and so forth, and you have a beginning teacher, you pay them $39,000, $40,000, they can't live, so they have to have a roommate. So immediately you're saying to somebody, well, you're not worth a lot. And so all over the country, people going into education have declined 30% fewer than several years ago. I think it's coming back up, but this is very important. I know that in this school district, they've taken the reading coaches and put them in the classes. Well, if you do that, you all of a sudden are not having your teachers learn how to teach reading.
Arthur Shapiro is here. His book is Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. He is a professor at the College of Education at USF in Tampa. He got his PhD from the University of Chicago, and this is 88.5 FM. And Arthur, I want to ask you about the impact of low income. I was talking to the school superintendent of Manatee County a couple of years ago. She said about 52% of their kids in Manatee County get free or reduced prices of lunch and get subsidized breakfast or free school breakfast. Those are indications of poverty.
Yeah.
In fact, Manatee County is not an outlier. Most counties have this situation where about half the kids, maybe a little bit more of the kids are eligible for free or reduced lunches or free school breakfast. So that means that about half the kids in public schools around this listening area are in poverty. What impact does that have? You talked about test scores being tied to poverty rates a moment ago.
Yeah. I've seen something last year. About 47% of Floridians have trouble making ends meet. Well, if you have trouble making ends meet, you're anxious. You're saying, you know, do I go to a dentist? Well, no, you don't go to a dentist. You try, what can I do to pay the electric bill? Well, you got a problem. So what this does is parents are focused on trying to make a living, trying to get your previous people talked about their drivers, their custodian, their drivers work 10 months. Well, what do they do with the other 2 months?
Yeah, not many employers want to hire you for just 2 months.
No.
Yeah.
No, so they're out of luck.
Let's take some phone calls. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and I hope I pronounced this name right. Marshery from Tampa. Is that you, Marshery?
Yes, it is.
Thank you for calling. What would you like to ask Arthur?
Well, I am one of the mothers who has my 8-year-old second grade in a public school. It's a great public school. They have all the resources they need. However, I'm kind of looking for something outside of the box, so to speak. I want my son to have more hands-on learning and have different options available, so I have been looking at charter schools. I found one that I have been researching. They offer a foreign language starting in third grade. The teacher that teaches the third grade allows the children to sit on big exercise balls, bean bags, stools, whatever they want, basically to give a different vibe in the classroom. And just they do a little bit more hands-on as well with the learning. So my son is very active, and I thought maybe that would kind of cater to him a little bit better, to where he feels like he's a better student. And so the public school system's great, but it just doesn't offer a lot of different options for learning, especially for the kids that are younger who have a lot of energy. So I'm basically nervous about him switching schools, but I also wanted to ask you, what are some things that I should look for that you may be able to direct me in, as far as like red flags or things that to stay away from when looking to change schools from a public school to a charter school, if I'm going to go that route?
What's the next class up when your child gets out of that class and has a good experience? What's the next teacher like?
Yeah, he's had like issues since kindergarten all the way through second grade with his energy level, and that's why I'm looking for something different to maybe teach him a little bit differently and allow him to be a kid and have his, you know, energy level, his hands-on experience, to make learning a little bit more fun instead of testing and sit in your seat and things of that nature.
The problem with this testing mania, we're now testing kids in kindergarten. When you really didn't learn to read in kindergarten, what about a Waldorf school or a school which attempts to have activities for kids? There are some schools that focus on that. Have you thought about any school like that?
Nope, and I didn't really know about that. I'm just kind of researching in hopes of getting him somewhere new for third grade. So that's a great suggestion I'll have to look into, because I really can't afford a private school. So it's like with the voucher situation going on, it's like part of me agrees with that, because I can't afford to send my son to a different school that's private, even with the scholarships that are available. But on the other hand, I don't want to take away from the public schools either.
You might want to look for a Montessori school. You might want to look for a school that really has alternate kinds of learning styles that might fit your son's energy a little bit better.
All right. Marjorie, thanks a lot. Thank you. What about the longevity of a charter school? I mean, if the charter school has been around for 1 or 2 years, as a parent, I might wonder whether it's going to be around for 2 more years.
Yeah, you're quite right. The lifespan of charter schools is not very good. There was one charter school I was reading that just closed, bang, because they're out of money. So that's a big problem. The charter schools, I humorously and seriously say a charter school is a business looking to be called a school.
You mentioned the Waldorf system of education. Mm-hmm. I think some of the Unitarian churches around mm-hmm. here sponsored Waldorf schools. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned Montessori. Those are private, though. I mean, how do you afford that if this mom doesn't have money to
that's send? She can't.
So that's why she likes the idea of a voucher. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We're talking with Arthur Shapiro about his book, Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's go to Glenn, who's in Manatee County. Glenn, what would you like to say?
Well, first of all, I would like to address the 7,000 vacancies in the state.
And a large part of that problem is housing. Housing, housing, housing. In our community of Manatee, the large developers refuse to do any affordable housing. So you have an entry-level school teacher making $44,000 that has to go into these walled communities and teach these students. But at the end of the day, the developers say, well, if you can't afford a $300,000 house, you'll just have to drive out of our walled community and go find something. Housing is very difficult here in Manatee County, especially at the entry level, and that goes for not only school teachers, goes for firefighters, EMS, entry-level workers, and even the sheriff. So there's no affordable housing. The second issue is that, you know, if we stop raiding the Sadowski Fund, they might be able to do that, but the developers have had 20 years to step up to the plate to do something about affordable housing, and they haven't. The county commission says it's a capitalist market. We can't help you out. So there's a real disparity between the housing and the entry-level workers, not only in Manatee County, but I think all over. And the second issue is that nobody wants to address, what are the numbers of your homeless students in the 67 counties of Florida? In Manatee, there are over 2,000 homeless students in Manatee County. But nobody wants to address that either. You wonder, and I teach at a Title I school. So you wonder why they're sleeping in your class? Because they're living in their car or in the woods, and nobody's stepping up the plate to help these homeless students in the housing. College there at 14%. So there's a lot of things that we can improve on. You know, I've suggested, you know, we're building three new schools in Manatee County. Why not have housing units on campus? You know, the new one, the North River High School, it's like on 100 acres. Take 10 acres and put affordable housing in there. For the teachers, you know, our entry-level teachers are coming in at $44,000, coming from a dormitory, and, you know, they can't find an efficiency under $1,100 a month.
All right, Glenn, thanks a lot. Thanks for making those points. We'll go back to Arthur now. Arthur, housing, it's unaffordable, not just in Manatee County. There's a lot of counties.
Unaffordable everywhere.
In the city of Tampa, affordable housing is disappearing in the city of Tampa. I think the same is true in St. Petersburg.
That's why your beginning teachers have to get a roommate to make it through, and even that's hard. You addressed for your previous people. You were talking about the decline in the middle class, and that's a big piece. This is what this caller is talking about. He's saying the middle class is declining. What is a tragedy is the business of homeless students. There are a lot more than we think.
I've heard some school superintendents talk about the importance of wraparound services.
Yes.
And by that, they mean that all social services, that families are fragmented now, and kids may not be getting the health care they need. They may not be getting the mental health care that they need. And they may not be getting the food they need. So that schools should not just be a school, they should have other services available. But what about wraparound services?
Wraparound is what you should have. You got to get your medical services to all kids. That's part of what you have to have. Other societies have it. The Scandinavian countries have it, and a lot of the European countries have it. And wraparound services mean that in the summer these kids have some food for them. On weekends, they've got to have meals because they don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important.
Tell me which countries or which states are doing the best when it comes to providing a quality education for kids, whatever the means is, whether it's private schools or public schools. What countries, what states are doing the best?
The states, Connecticut is usually number one.
Why are they number one?
They spend a lot more money. I was a superintendent in New York. I'm a Midwesterner. I came to the South a long time ago, and I love the South. But you have to be realistic. If you're going to, for instance, in a high school here, your teacher, you're lucky to have two foreign languages. Okay, my high school, which was on Long Island, as it's mispronounced, we had not only the French and the French and the Spanish, but we had German, we had Russian, we had Italian, we had Swahili, because we had money.
So you were able to teach these foreign languages to the students.
Sure.
How does teaching a foreign language help the academic performance?
Well, I think when kids learn more of foreign languages, it expands the world for them. I have a friend next door who's from Portugal, and she just realizes that having other foreign languages is very educational. You learn a few things.
I think it's in the Michael Moore film, Where to Invade Next. They talk about education around the world, one of the topics. And Michael points out that I think it's in Finland where they don't have homework, but they teach, or they treat teachers as professionals, yeah, on par with doctors,
yes,
and lawyers. That if you're a teacher, you're not just, you know, they don't look at you as a blue-collar worker at,
yep,
$44,000, $47,000 a year. You're at an elevated status within your community.
You're highly respected in Finland. Finland has one of the best educational systems in the world, but they don't pursue a whole bunch of this fad, that fad. I wrote a book on education under siege, frauds, fads, fantasies and fictions in educational reform. And this sounds like it's going to work. Let's jump on that bandwagon.
I was reading today, there's an op-ed in the Tampa Bay Times by the speaker, by a member of the Florida House.
Yep.
Or maybe it's the Florida Senate. I forgot,
yeah,
who wrote it. Aliva wrote it. And he said, look, if you look at the outcomes, since Jeb Bush began to focus on his ideas about education, that the graduation rate in the state of Florida has increased. So and Jeb tried to give us taxpayer-funded vouchers. He was unsuccessful because of the Florida Supreme Court. But he did have this idea of testing students, of grading schools.
Oh, yes, he did.
Doing away with tenure for teacher, all the ideas that you don't like. But the op-ed in the Tampa Bay Times says, if you look at the outcomes now, we have a better graduation rate in the state of Florida.
Okay. I'm extremely suspicious of graduation rates because you can code anything you darn please. So, for instance, George Bush made his great reputation by saying that there were three inner-city high schools in Texas, in the big city in Texas, that had no dropouts. You know, they had a fellow who was a Vietnam War major who said, "What is he talking about? I have 1,000 kids coming in ninth grade, and I have 300 coming out." So, of course, they attacked him. What they did was to code kids who left any way they wanted, so they wouldn't have a dropout rate. The graduation rate has improved to some extent. Yes, it has, but you have to be very careful believing in graduation rates.
So don't always trust those figures.
Oh,
that's one important figure, but there's many important figures.
Yeah.
One of the figures would be how many of the kids get into college, I would think.
Yes, that's one.
Yeah.
And charter schools, some charter schools maintain that they'll get all their kids into college. They don't, but they maintain they can get their kids into college.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one more phone call. I think people are beginning to jump on this topic. Let's go to Antonio in St. Petersburg. Antonio, we just have 30 seconds. What would you like to say or ask?
Well, I think there might be, it looks like they're trying to phase out, or eventually might do away with it all. Maybe they just want everybody at home, homeschool from the internet. That way they don't got to pay for buses, pension, they don't got to do raises, they don't got to do anything else.
Homeschooling doesn't work because most kids, about 60% of kids learn from interaction with each other. You homeschool a kid and he doesn't have any interaction. How does a kid learn to be an adolescent but by talking with other adolescents?
So there's a lot of intangibles that you pick,
yeah,
up at school.
Oh, schools are socializing institutions, sure.
Yeah. Antonio's point, I think, is that he thinks that what the government wants to do is eventually do away with public schools.
Public schools were the key to our society, where they're run by boards of education of citizens. And you hire people supposedly with expertise, but the public school is an integral institution to socialize kids. It's just not learning to pass tests, but to socialize kids to become a decent kid.
Thomas Jefferson, a big fan of public schools.
Oh, big isn't the word.
All right. Well, Arthur Shapiro, thanks a lot for coming by again on WMNF. Nice to see you.
My pleasure, and hello.
Arthur Shapiro teaches at USF at the Education Department. His latest book is Combat Zone, The Continuing War Against the Public Schools. We've been talking about it, and this is 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. If you want to comment about the show today, call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play it back Monday. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF Tampa. Here's the news.